could get everyone's attention before my voice gives out. My name is John Lopatin, and I'm the president of the board of Mahon Hadar, and I'd like to welcome you here. Could we just have a show of hands? How many of you are here for the first time? That's wonderful. Well, yeah. So I'd like to, it's my job to introduce Rabbi Eli Kanfer, our speaker tonight. I think that Pesach is a time of learning, so this is a great moment for us to learn from Rav Eli, and we really look forward to it. Thank you.
Thank you. Great. It's great to be here and to have the opportunity to learn with all of you tonight. The goal of our evening is to explore the story of the Jewish people as seen through the lens of the Haggadah. I know that many of you are here for the free wine, and the rest of you are probably here to take home something for your Seder. So if you miss the wine, I'm hoping that you'll at least take home something for your Seder. I want to sort of first give thanks to the folks who did... The world of exploring the Haggadah is a field in which every single year there is a blockbuster new Haggadah that comes out on the market. Every single year. Imagine if that was the case for a Sidur or something like that. It would be insanity. But, you know, I rely on many, many people who come before in investigating the Haggadah, specifically looking at some of the ideas brought tonight in the Shechtar Haggadah by Josh Culp, and also the Haggadah that was written by David Silber, a teacher of mine, and Rachel First. So I want to... thank them for all their research. Okay, if you were going to tell the story of the Jewish people, how would you frame it? What plot items would you include in the story of the Jewish people? That's not a rhetorical question. I'm actually asking you. Yeah, please start, Thomas. Set. Abraham. Okay, great. Your story. Begins and ends with Abraham?
No.
Okay.
That would be included.
Okay, great. So we're going to include Abraham. Excellent. Okay. It doesn't have to be characters, it can also be events. Yeah.
Yithyat
Mitzrayim. Okay, great. Coming out of Egypt. That one has really, we run with that one. Okay. Other plot elements? Yeah, please.
The state of Israel.
The state of Israel. Okay, great. We did not put an end time. Actually, as a kid, I used to ask my dad if he could tell the story of the Jewish people from coming out of Egypt to the state of Israel. And he had this amazing... He skipped hundreds of years in the middle there, but he had a great arc of a story.
Maybe the generation of the flood and the Dormammu.
Ah, okay, backing it up before Avram to get to the flood and starting with that. Yeah, Bethany.
Matan Torah.
Ah, okay. This seems to be an important nation building moment. Beginning of the Torah, presumably at Mount Sinai. Yeah.
The first Benetarium and the other priesthoods with the
Avot. Ah, okay. So now I'm just going to drill down a little bit on Abraham, the covenant of the pieces. We're going to look a little bit in depth around that a little bit later on. Yeah, Philip.
The destruction of the temple.
The destruction of the temple. Where is that? That's somewhere between coming out of Egypt and the state of Israel. Right here. Okay. That's the destruction of the temple. Yeah, please, Michal.
The Holocaust.
The Holocaust. Okay, great. Right before the state of Israel. Right here. This is a long history. Yeah, you were going to say. Please.
No, I was
going to
say the experience of anti-Semitism.
The experience of anti-Semitism. Okay, great. Related. Okay, as you can see, we'll take a couple more.
The Haskalah of
Jewish Enlightenment. We're standing in the house built by Mordechai Kaplan. We have to mention the Haskalah. Okay, so the Enlightenment, and we'll take one last one, please.
The building of the temple.
The building of the temple, okay. There we go, okay. You know how that works. So as you can see, there's a lot of plot lines that you could follow if you were going to explore the history of the Jewish people. And we're going to look at the way in which the Haggadah does that tonight. And like many things in Jewish parlance, I'm having this around, it is a debate. And the debate is probably more complicated than we realize.
So, that.
I'm actually going to, yeah. Once you have that sheet, I'm going to give you another sheet. A lot of wine was consumed and a lot of trees were consumed for tonight's. Okay. Sorry?
Let's hold on another one.
Okay, thank you. Okay, the project of telling the story of the Jewish people is outlined in the Haggadah. We know that it's actually, Rabbi Silver points this out, that only we have a commandment every day to remember, but only once a year to tell. Once a year we have a commandment to tell the story. And the way that the Mishnah, the sort of formative text of Jewish law, states that is in the first source here. So could somebody just read in the first box, according to the knowledge / ability?
According to the knowledge / ability of the child, should his father instruct him. One begins with shame / disgrace, and one finishes with praise. And expounds from, my father was a wandering Aramean / an Aramean, tried to destroy my father, Deuteronomy 26:5, until he finishes the entire section.
Great. Thank you. Very well read. As you can see, that there are a number of ambiguities in the translation and understanding here in this very, very short piece. This is the instruction that the Haggadah is trying to fulfill. So, starting with disgrace and ending in, or shame and disgrace, ending with praise, shevach, how do we actually instantiate that? How do we build that out? Now, there's one fundamental debate here, and this is what we're going to be exploring throughout the night here. What is the shame, and what is the praise? Where are we moving? On the arc of the story, from disgrace to praise, where are we going to go? It's a famous debate in the Talmud that we're going to look at, but we're going to see other angles of it, so if you think you know what the answer is, I invite you to still pay attention. Okay. So, give me just from this text itself, is there a reading in this text itself that explains where the move from disgrace or shame to praise is to be found?
Brian. It implies that starting with the father being a wandering Aramean is the shame and disgrace part.
Okay, great. So it seems like one reasonable read of this mission, a number of scholars have proposed this, is that the explanation of moving from gnut, shame, to shevach, praise, is in fact laid out in the next part of the mission, which says you should read this, or you should expound on these verses that begin, my father was a wandering Aramean, or as understood by the Haggadah, an Aramean tried to destroy my father. Until he finishes the entire section. Now, let's just take a brief moment to look at the full version of this, which is below. But and I want you to, when we read this text, I want you to pay attention. Where would you draw the line between shame, disgrace, and praise? Okay, that's the exercise we're going to do when we take a look at the selection below. Does someone want to read that out loud? Yes, Ariel, you shall.
So then recite as follows before Adonai, your God. My father was a wandering Aramean, or an Aramean tried to destroy my father. He went down to Egypt with meager numbers and sojourned there. But there he became a great and very populous nation. The Egyptians dealt harshly with us and oppressed us. They imposed heavy labor upon us. We cried out to Adonai, the God of our fathers, and Adonai heard our plea and saw our plight, our misery, and our oppression. Adonai freed us from Egypt by a mighty hand, by an outstretched arm, and awesome power, and by signs and wonders. He brought us to this place and gave us this land, a land flowing with milk and honey. Now I bring the first fruits of the soil which you, Adonai, have given.
Great. Okay, now I followed the instructions of the Mishnah, which the Mishnah said, Achid mor kol ha-parasha kula. Go until the end of the section. That is to say, the quote ends at the part where I cut it off. In Hebrew, I actually brought the end of the Masoretic section, which goes one more verse, but it's actually more of a description of what the person says after it. Now, just for some context, we're talking about the bringing of the first fruits to the temple, which does not happen in Passover. It happens on Shavuot. And this is the selection that the pilgrim would say. Okay? Now, in the Haggadah, we don't read the entire selection. We cut it off at the break, at that line. So we end with signs and wonders. Okay? Now, taking the if you take the Mishnah seriously and say, until the end of this section, give me some reading of this passage which identifies what is the shame and what is the praise. Okay, let's start with the shame. What's the shame?
Wandering Aramean.
Okay, wandering Aramean. Good. Now, in that read, the Aramean, Arameo Vedavi, my father was a wandering Aramean, just spell out, what's the shame around that? Is it, does this...
Well, that contrasts more with the part that gets cut off, being kind of wandering versus being, having a home base, a land that's flowing with milk and honey.
Okay, fantastic. So what Brian is suggesting is that the emphasis in my father was a wandering Aramean was the wandering part, right? Obey. Okay? The wanderer is the disgrace, and then as you pointed out, the praise is, just read it out for us.
He brought us to this place and gave us this land, the land flowing with milk and honey.
Good. So he moves from wander to the land. Okay? And that's a narrative that that is encoded here with Arami Oved Avi. My father was a wandering Aramean. Other thoughts for the disgrace and praise flow? Yeah, Lily.
Is there something negative about being an Aramean?
Let's play that one out for a second, okay? You're starting from the beginning. My father was a wandering Aramean. So now, if, again, reading this as my father was a wandering Aramean, not an Aramean tried to destroy my father, which depends if obeyed is an adjective or a verb. But let's just go with the Aramean. What if my father was a wandering Aramean as opposed to a wandering Aramean, right? So we're going to have Arami. What's the disgrace in the Arami?
Idolatry.
Idolatry, okay. And then what is the, can you find the praise?
Dwelling on the fact that these are the descendants of Abraham. They're saying instead, they're descendants from Aram.
Good. Okay. So now we're actually focusing on less on a geographical move and more on a theological move, right? My father used to be an idolater, idolatry, and then moved to monotheism. Okay? That's another flow that's play on here. Any other thoughts about from degradation to praise? Yeah. No. Okay. Great. Cut off that line of reasoning quick. Yes.
I think the opening phrase is maybe incidental, and the Gnut is slavery and being downtrodden, and the Shabbat is being redeemed.
Okay. Great. So you're actually focusing on Vayered Mitzrayimah. Right? That is to say, the enslavement that happened in Egypt is the... Am I saying this right? Is the degradation? Okay, so slavery. And then what's the praise? What's the flip side of that?
Redemption. Exodus.
The Exodus, the coming out, as opposed to the coming to the land. Right? Those are two separate... You want to connect them, or...?
Well, that's further...
Further down, okay, but okay, good. So we'll leave that ambiguous whether the opposite of slavery is coming out or coming into the land. But nevertheless, we're going to look at that as a third model. Yeah, please.
There's a contrast in numbers from being meager numbers to becoming
a great. Okay, great. We have another thing, which is to say, you came out small numbers, and then you get many, many numbers. Right, the numbers go up. That's my running out of room way of saying that. Okay, yeah, Alan.
Kind of a side question, but I'm wondering if the phrase that we have here, where our what is quoted in our Haggadah's ends, whether that exists in like a Sefer Torah, like if there is like a parsha break there, or if in the Mishnah when it says Achi Gmor Kol HaParsha Kula, it actually is assuming that you're going to continue through the possession of the land.
Right. So as far as I'm aware, the question is there a break where the Haggadah puts a break in the actual Masoretic text of the Torah? The Masoretes didn't do that. There is a scholarly theory that this section was actually taken in from another Mishnah in Bikurim, which is describing what the pilgrim should say. And it makes a lot more sense to say the pilgrim should say this all the way up until the end of the section, and what you say on Seder night is actually not limited to this Kol HaParashat Kula. In fact, if you're going to stop like the Haggadah does, you don't have to go and say, and here I present my first fruits, because it doesn't make any sense on Seder night. So there is, the idea of finishing the entire section is, at least one theory says, it's sort of schlepped in from somewhere else. Okay, there's more we could talk about this. I think we've identified some of the major flows from Gnut to Shevach, from degradation to praise. And now I want to actually take a look at the... Yeah, Anne.
I was just going to add one other thing, and I'm not sure if it's Gilead.com, and the first part was sort of wandering and a sort of an aimless quality, but then the contrast with the relational piece of relationship with God, that we do when God saves us and we thank and we pray.
Ah, okay, so there's sort of like the wandering, it's not necessarily the idolatry, or maybe it's related, but there's sort of the I'm lost, I'm in my 20s kind of thing, and then it's fine, I know most of you are enjoying it, and then I finally found my relationship, as it were. Okay, great, if I hadn't lost my marker, I would add that on. But anyways, we're going to move on, and let's take a look at the way in which... Thank you. It was there all the time. Let's take a look at the way in which the Gemara deals with this. So first of all, you all came up with those storylines from the section of Deuteronomy 26:5 through 10 that, as we'll see, is not the text that we quote to bring forward from degradation to praise. Okay? Totally reasonable. There's many, many storylines that you have in this selection that could take us from degradation to praise, but that's not where the Talmud moves. Talmud goes in another direction. Okay, so hold on to your hats here because it's going to get a little manuscripty. All right. Who's going to read us? One begins. It's not going to impact the way you need to read, so don't be afraid. Yeah, Rachel.
One begins with shame / disgrace, and one finishes with praise. What is shame / disgrace? Rav said, in the beginning our ancestors were idol worshippers. Shmuel / Rava said, you were slaves.
Okay, let's stop there for a second. This is the fundamental understanding of the Mishnah. They quote the Mishnah, which says we move from degradation to praise. And now we have this famous machloket, the famous if you know it, the famous machloket between Rav and Shmuel, which is the basis for two different traditions of identifying shame and praise. So let's start with Shmuel, okay? Shmuel says, Avadim hayinu leparo mimitzrayim, which is, let's choose, of the sort of storylines that we put over here, this would be the one in which you start with slavery, and you end with going out of Egypt. Now, it's not exactly clear where either Rav or Shmuel identify the praise. It seems like they're focusing mainly on the degradation. But for Shmuel, we're talking about slavery, and that is a different text from Deuteronomy 6. We'll look at that a little bit later on. And what does Rav say? Rav actually doesn't quote any text at all. Rav says, "Mitchila ovdei avodat kilulim avodat zarah ayu avotenu." Right? In the beginning, machil. Okay? Begin with mitchila. In the beginning, our ancestors were idol worshippers. So this is the basic debate that's happening here. Is it about moving from slavery to freedom? Or we don't, freedom here is a placeholder because we actually don't know where the Shevach is. Is it moving from slavery to something else? Or is it moving from idolatry to something else? Yeah, Molly.
In that case, we would probably have to stop the story a little later if this was going to be going from a state that we're into a state that we're not. In terms of idolatry, kind of continues after they cross the Red Sea.
Okay, great. Okay, good. Okay, now, what Molly's bringing up is that the relationship between the Jewish people and idolatry was a little more sine-curvy than the relationship between Egypt and leaving Egypt. Okay, so, and that's, I think, important for the text that is ultimately associated with Rav. Okay. Now, let's just read a little bit. Sorry, let's do one other thing. This is typically identified as a debate between Rav and Shmuel. Rav and Shmuel were contemporaries. Okay, they're the first generation after the close of the Mishnah. Actually, they're so close to the Mishnah that they were students of the editor of the Mishnah, at least Rav was, and you would imagine that this wouldn't be so unclear. After all, it was just taught by the Mishnah, and Rav is now trying to explain what this is, so maybe, you know, let's sort of, why is there already confusion around this? Now, one of the things that's important to note is that we have both of these answers in our Haggadah. We're going to look at that in a second here. Actually, I'm going to pass out, this is, for those of you who didn't bring a Haggadah, this is a good old Maxwell House, red, and line numbers, and the whole thing, okay? So we're going to take a look at the Haggadah. As it's going on, we'll just focus a little bit here. But I want to raise something that Josh Kopf does a great job of explaining, which is to say, If the debate is between Rav and Shmuel, sorry, there's one for every other person for the Haggadah, so I've got some of you agree with, so if you can share, that's great. If the debate is between Rav and Shmuel, then fundamentally you have a debate of equals. Okay? They're the same time period, they lived at, they're having many, many debates, and you can go in one direction or the other. But typically, when we have a debate between two principles, we choose a side. Right? That is to say, at the end of the day, when there's a debate, you either go with Rav or you go with Shmuel. What's unusual about our Haggadah is that we go by both. Now, I say ours specifically because we're going to look at a Haggadah that doesn't go by both of them. But for now, just note that we actually go by both. And you can see that in the Haggadah that I just brought out here. So this is like the first part of the Magid section. I labeled it by letter. So if you start on page 8, you have Halach Ma'anya. We'll get back to that at the end. Then you have Manishana, the four questions. Okay? Then C, Abadim Hayinu Lefaro B'Mitzrayim. Okay, on page 9 in the middle, that is Shmuel's answer. Okay, Shmuel is brought first in the Haggadah. Then you have a few other things. You have the five sages in D. You have the four sons in E. And moving through until you get to page 11, F. Mitchila Ovdei Kochavim Hayu Avoteinu. Who's that? Rav. Okay? So what we have here is our Haggadah has both Shmuel and Rav. Let's just note that. And note how, in many liturgical instances, things don't get chosen, they get added. And that's why the Sidur is bigger than it used to be, and so is the Haggadah. We're going to see an example of a very small Haggadah. Please. Okay, so you're saying maybe by putting Shmuel's position first, we were slaves and then we were brought out, that that's actually privileging that answer, because it comes first and then only... Right, well, that all depends how you read narrative in rabbinic understanding, because narrative can be, as you're suggesting, linear, where first is better, as my five-year-old would constantly say. That's recorded for posterity. And now, or you could read it with the middle being the most important. That's to say, like, if you think of the book of Vayikra, which we're in now.
But it's not about being the most important.
Uh-huh.
The Mishnah is talking in clear linear terms, right? It's not saying what's most important is shame, what's less important is praise. And you start with shame and you end with praise. Right?
Correct.
So here it's clearly starting with praise. I mean, it's not with shame. It's not a question of which one we're privileging. It's a question of what literally.
Good. Okay, so I'll just to break it down. These are two stories of shame and praise that are their own self-contained thing. So if you look at page 9, Avadim Ayinu Lefaro B'Mitzrayim, next phrase, Vayotzienu Adonai Eloheinu Misham. He took us out. That's the end of this narrative. And then for Rav, when you have Mitchila, where are we on page 11? Mitchila Ovdei Kochavim Hayu Avoteinu, Ve'achshav Kerbanu La'Makom La'Avodatel. Right? First, we were idolaters. Then, God brought us close to His service. So I think what you're having here is that the full expression of shame and praise is brought one serially after the other. Now, which one is privileged, if you bring both of them, we could debate. Now, one thing important to point out here is that we often, those who are familiar with associating these names, these positions with Rav and Shmuel, what Josh Kull points out is that it's actually misattributed to Shmuel. And if you turn over, just because I spent a lot of time doing this, if you turn over to page 8, the very last page, okay, for all you. What this is, the very last page, of the one that looks like this, we're looking at a chart like this, okay? What this chart demonstrates is these are all the existing manuscripts of the Talmud for this selection. There's 10 of them. One of them is the printing that we have, the Vilna edition, which is labeled number 1. That's the one that we quoted in the source that we looked at. And there you can see the full expression of Rav says his position, we were idolaters, and Shmuel says we were slaves. Now you notice Shmuel is in brackets. If you don't read Hebrew, don't worry about it. I'm going to direct you to the line that has the brackets on it in column number 1. That says Shmuel. That's Shmuel's position. If you read across, notice who shows up in all the manuscripts. only one other appearance of Shmuel, but you either have some version of Resh Bet X, right? Either Rav, Rava, Ravin, Rava. Okay? Now there's a whole article, Shama Freeman wrote a whole article about how basically every time in the Gemara it says Rava or Rava, we actually don't know who it was. Rava was Rava's teacher, just to make things more confusing. You know, but ultimately, even with the term Rav, you can see that this is some very similar scribal version of this name, but it looks something like Shmuel. Okay? Shmuel shows up here. You know, Shmuel is a natural argument compatriot to Rav. So if I want to make things look nice and smooth, I have Rav versus Shmuel. Rav versus Rava is a totally different story. It's an intergenerational debate that is, in fact, unusual. Rav and Rava don't debate directly. Okay? They're just living in different time periods. I know Talmud's about intergenerational debate, but trust me. Okay, right? So Shmuel is the stand-in that makes a lot of sense, who's debating Rav. But if it's Rav and Rava, you have a different story here. Now, let's just connect this back for a second. Rav's position is moving from slavery, from idolatry to monotheism. Rava's position is moving from slavery to freedom. Why would they disagree about that? Why would Rava say, no, it's actually not, let's say Rava's coming after Rav. Let's say Rav set it up and said idolatry to monotheism is the story of Gnut to Sheva, of degradation to praise. Why would Rava come along and say, moves from slavery to freedom? Why do you think? Why change it? What's wrong? It's a great story. We were idolaters, now we're monotheists. Yeah.
I think it's two totally different narratives from different sort of fundamental points of view. Like, one is an internally imposed sort of, you know, a choice-based idea of moving from idolatry to monotheism, and one is an externally imposed, you know, oppression from slavery to freedom. So I feel like I see it as external versus internal.
Okay, great. So one major difference is that who is at fault for the gnut, for the degradation of slavery? Not me. Although I was having the conversation with somebody about, well, maybe Joseph was a little bit implicated, but we'll talk about that in another shiur, okay? But fundamentally, the Egyptians enslaved us, right? As opposed to in idolatry, right, we're at fault. No one forced me to be an idolater. Or at least that's not how it's spelled out in the way that Rav tells the story. Our ancestors were idolaters. Yeah, Shoshi.
I think that in from slavery to coming out of slavery, that God is able to have a bigger hand. God is the one who brought us out of slavery, that without God we wouldn't have been able to do it. Versus idolatry to monotheism could just be like a societal trend. It may or may not have
occurred. We're riding the wave. It's the latest fad. Right, yeah. No, exactly. Right, but the idea here is that God as an active character in this story is very, very strong. Whereas here, you know, perhaps, it depends how you view the sort of, I mean, ultimately, God selected Abraham. Well, depends how you're reading it. In other words, was Abraham the one who God selected Abraham because he was the one who smashed the idols in the Midrash, and therefore he's the one ripe for monotheism, and therefore you could give him some credit for it? Or was it sort of, you know, it's time for monotheism, let's go with this guy, and then God is active actually in both stories. But okay, maybe God is more, certainly is more on display in this story than in the sort of movement for idolatry to monotheism. Yeah.
I would say the text of God would be like that, and that it says,
good. Okay, so we're giving the credit to God, at least in the words of Rav, as demonstrated by the Haggadah, where God is the actor in this flow. Right. Okay. So you have a debate about where God is more strongly present, but nevertheless, it's a godly thing. Yeah, John.
I'm not sure if this really out of my order, but when I looked at this, I thought that the story of the movement to monotheism could be looked at as being more generic and less specifically our familiar story. I realize it's Abraham, so that would contradict that. But nonetheless, we're talking about a movement from idolatry, certainly in terms that we're using in English, we're talking about a movement from idolatry to monotheism. monotheism.
Right, right.
And it's sort of easier, it's much, that lends itself to something more general.
Yeah, good. Maybe we should be more exact on our terminology here with monotheism. It's like, well, monotheism, that's, you know, Western religion,
well,
whatever.
That's not what they meant.
Right. I think Kervanila, but I'll tell service, right? It's, you know, I was serving many gods, now I serve the one God, and that's sort of the one God who has the relationship with Israel. Maybe that would make it more, less, you know, sort of everybody's included, anybody who believes in one power is included in that story, although maybe you want to go in that direction. Yeah.
I think that kind of a lot of the answers are spreading around is, well, what makes the Jewish people a nation? What is essential about the Jewish people? And both of these are answers to that question. They're just very different answers.
Good. Okay. Good. Now we're sort of going to drill down to the fundamental thing. Why have this debate? Right? What is the Jewish people fundamentally about? Is it about a belief, or is it about a journey, or is it a journey of belief, or a journey physically? Right? Is it an experience that we all share together in being slaves, or is it an experience we all share together in being idolaters? Is it something about our ancestors here who are named in this text versus something that's more broad? Let's just look at one other understanding of Rav, which may include one of our other, or maybe both of our other paradigms here. So if you flip, okay, sorry, we're back in this sheet here, the one that everybody has, and we're now going to flip over the page to page 2. Okay. Now Rav's position. Again, this is Rav over here. This is Shmuel. Rav is the older one, and Rav is the more recent one. Okay? Rav is the only position that shows up in the Jerusalem Talmud. Right? There's two Talmudim, one that represents the Babylonian tradition, one that represents the Palestinian tradition. And Rav is the only one in the Palestinian Talmud. Rav Amar, and this is a difficult text, corrupted, whatever, he says something like either mitchila or kitchila. As I translate here, as in the beginning. He says one word, as in the beginning. And then, depending whether you cut these words or not, either says you have to begin, but most people cut it. So, as in the beginning, Rav says, as in the beginning, colon, quote, our ancestors dwelt beyond the river Euphrates. Me'ever anar yashbu avotenu. But I took your father Avram from beyond the river, and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Okay? So what's the fundamental difference here between the Jerusalem Talmud and the Babylonian Talmud? Well, first is, we don't have anybody disagreeing with Rav. Right? It's just Rav. The entire story is about Avraham, our ancestors dwelled beyond the river Euphrates, and they were idolaters, and I took them, you know, beyond the river Euphrates, etc., that whole story. We're going to look at that in a second. That's the story that Rav tells. Nobody disagrees with him. Okay? And that makes sense in a world in which it's not Rav versus Shmuel, but Rav, who was born in Eretz Israel, moved to Babylonia later, but he's all over the Palestinian Talmud. There's Rav versus Rava, who's three generations later in Bavel. Okay? Rava doesn't show up in the Palestinian Talmud, even though you might expect Shmuel to. So what we fundamentally have is two traditions around the telling of the story. In the Babylonian Talmud, it's a debate between leaving slavery and leaving idolatry. And in the Jerusalem Talmud, it's all about idolatry. Rav is the only position that's held here. Now, let's look at Rav more carefully here, because Rav doesn't say, in the Babylonian Talmud, this is the other distinction, in the Babylonian Talmud, what does Rav say? Rav says, not a quote of a verse, but in fact, a summary of a verse. Right? What does he say? You flip back to page 1 if you don't remember. In the beginning, our ancestors were idol worshippers. So that's very clear that he's identifying degradation with idol worship. Now in the Yerushalmi, what could the genut be of Rav? What could the degradation be? Right? You can take a look at the full version of that page 3. This is what Rav is recommending us to say. Hold on one second. Let's take a look at page 3. Joshua said to all the people. I'm on the bolded part on page 3. This is Joshua 24:2. This is what the Lord, the God of Israel, said. Long ago, your ancestors, including Terach, the father of Abraham and Nahor, lived beyond the river Euphrates and worshipped other gods. But I took your father Abraham from the land beyond the Euphrates, and I led him throughout Canaan and gave him many descendants. I gave him Isaac, and to Isaac I gave Jacob and Esau. I assigned the hill country of Seir to Esau, but Jacob and his family went down to Egypt. That's where the Haggadah ends. Okay, that's the quote that Rav says in the way that our Haggadah reads it. That's what the Rishalmi is saying that Rav was saying. So, if the Babylonian Talmud identifies Rav with idolatry, is there any other way you could read this here? Does this selection fit any other paradigm? Yeah.
Not being in the land.
Not being in the land, right? Where now it could be not that Rav represents the movement from idolatry. This gets Eli Shevin's question. What is the core issue of the Jewish people? Is the Jewish people a nation because they moved from idolaters to the service of God? Is it because they went through the experience of moving from slavery to freedom, which is not mentioned here at all in certain ways? Or is it moving from wandering to the land? Right? And now you have another understanding where moving from wandering to the land is in fact a very clear possibility for Rav. That, I guess what I'm trying to say is the Babylonian Talmud forces Rav into a position of idolatry, and the Jerusalem Talmud just quotes the verse. And so it can lead to multiple interpretations. Yeah.
That to me makes more sense of why a later Babylonian teacher would reject it, because they're not in the land of Israel. There's no reason to keep them.
Good. Okay, now we have it. Now, if we understand that Rav was talking about moving from wandering to the land, now I understand why Rava, living in Babylonia, might say, you know what? That's not the story of the Jewish people. Right? The Jewish people isn't going to tell their story where they end up in Israel if they're sitting there in Babylonia. Right? That doesn't make for a very good, introduction to the meal, as it were. So now that's one possible reason why Rava, not Shmuel, was debating with Rav. The core story isn't about ending up in the land. The core story is about leaving Egypt. Okay? That's fundamentally the possibility. Now, when we have this tradition in the Yerushalmi, in the Jerusalem Talmud, versus the one in the Bavli, you can see where this is going. Okay? Where it's going to go is, I'm going to find out exactly where it's going. Let's take a look at where this ends up on page 2. This is what you're all really here for. It's not the wine. It's not the Indian food. So much leftovers. But it is for the Geniza, right? We're here for the Geniza people. And what we want to find out is, what did the discovery in the Geniza reveal about a whole other tradition of Haggadah that is not the Haggadah that we use? Okay? Now, to introduce that, I want to read two texts. The first one is source number 4, on page 2. Which is from the Rif, from Yitzhak Alfasi, who was a 10th century posek. You know, his job was go through the Talmud and sort of outline where the law should fall. So any disagreements, he's going to tell you, oftentimes, who we're siding with. And he has an interesting solution to this debate. He quotes our section from the Bavli, from the Babylonian Talmud, and he says, in text number 4 on page 2, Rav said, in the beginning, our ancestors were idol worshippers. Shmuel said, we were slaves. V'ha'idna avidna kitarvayu. Right? V'ha'idna avidna kitarvayu. Now, we do like both of them. Okay? This, you can thank the Rif and Rabbeinu Chananel and some other sort of early poskim for why our Haggadah is longer. Okay? We do both Rav and Shmuel or Rava. Right? We do both the idolatry narrative and the slavery narrative. Both of them are in there. Okay, you can argue which why one came first, one came the other. But this is an innovation. That is to say, the Rif didn't choose, I'm going with Rav, which you might have expected him to do. But instead, I'm going with both of them. Now, he's not the only opinion, because hanging out in 10th century, there's other pathways. And what I want to bring for you here is the way in which the Palestinian Haggadah didn't listen to this idea of Shmuel or Rava and have both opinions. In fact, it probably didn't even know of another opinion. It only had the idolatry opinion. And you can see that, I brought this just for fun special effects, at the end of this looking page, right, this looking source sheet, you've got one that looks like this. Okay? That's the last page. You can recognize it because it's illegible. Alright? So turn to the illegible page on the back. And where I put an arrow, that's matched up to box number 5 on the other source sheet on page 2. Alright, it's a little hard to read, I'm going to admit to you. But where the arrow starts, it reads like this. Lefi da'ato shel ben aviv. I'm now on the next line, milamdo. Can you find it at all? Now I'm in the bolder word, matchil. If you don't read it, we're going to change that in a second. Matchil bignut, next line, umisayim b'shevach. Okay, can you see it? Ve'omer. Be'ever ha'nahar yashvu avotechem. Right? So this is the Haggadah. Now, this is the Haggadah of the Eretz Yisrael tradition. It was discovered in the Geniza. It's published a number of times. This publication comes from Daniel Goldschmidt, who put a wonderful critical edition of the Haggadah out in 1960. And what you can see here from the Haggadah, first of all, just take a look at it. This is not your illuminated, this is not the Harbin Haggadah with the little drawings, right? This is the Haggadah. The Haggadah is like all of 12 pages long. And it's, you know, it's not in perfect handwriting, but it's in decent handwriting, okay? And it's small, right? You can sort of, this is a Haggadah I can read before I eat, right? Now, if you take a look on, turn back to page 2 of the other source sheet, okay? What we have in this, and what you see in box 5 is just what I read out to you. And I'll read it in the English. This is how the Haggadah from Eretz Yisrael from the Geniza moves. It says, it has the Manishana, how different is this night from all the nights? We didn't read that. It actually, it's a whole, we'll get to that in a second. And then it says, according to the knowledge or ability of the child, should his father instruct him. One begins with shame, disgrace, and one finishes with praise. Up until now, what are we doing? Quoting the Mishnah. Right? So the Eretz Yisrael Haggadah quotes the Mishnah directly. That doesn't show up in our Babylonian Haggadah. And then it simply says, and one says, long ago your ancestors lived beyond the Euphrates River. Right? That's Rav. So it happens very nicely. The Rav narrative here, the Rav narrative is preserved only in the Yerushalmi, right? Only in the Palestinian Talmud, and only in Eretz Yisrael Haggadah found in the Geniza. Okay? That makes sense. That's the way in which the Palestinian tradition moved forth. Whereas the Shmuel Rava position and the Rav position were joined together in the Babylonian Talmud, right, as both opinions, and then the Rif puts them both into the Haggadah. Okay? So that's how our Haggadah has a debate. I mean, it doesn't have a debate. You wouldn't know it's a debate unless you read the Gemara. But our Haggadah has two versions of this story, and the Palestinian Haggadah has only one. Now, if you look in box 6, you can see what else is missing in the Palestinian Haggadah. I'll leave you to decide which one you're going to use at your Seder. Okay? So what you have in the Babylonian Haggadah, we start off with Halach Ma'anya. All these letters correspond, if you want to look them up in the other sheet, they correspond there. Halach Ma'anya, this is the bread of affliction. God in the Palestinian Haggadah. They both have the four questions, but in the Palestinian Haggadah, it's actually three questions, sometimes two. That's a whole other lecture, okay? But fundamentally, the four is God. You have two or three questions, but they both have the questions. Then, what you have in the Babylonian Haggadah, see, Avadim Ayinu, that's Shmuel Rava's opinion. The five sages, the four sons, all that, gone in the Palestinian Haggadah. And then finally you have overlap. Okay? So the Palestinian Haggadah is the Haggadah of Rav, as was proposed. That is to say, the one story, the story of moving from idolatry to service. Yeah?
How can one reconcile that with the idea that they were in Matzah? I mean, if you completely forget the Exodus and slavery to freedom, then how do they connect the meal through the reading of the Haggadah beforehand? If what it is about being in...
Good, okay, so David's asking, well, what about, I mean, we all know that Pesach night is about, in fact, leaving Egypt, so what about that aspect and how you connect to the matzah? I didn't bring here, the Haggadah continues in both Eretz Yisrael and Bavel, and does, Rabbi Gamliel says you have to mention three things, both of them have that in there, and they talk about the matzah. So it's not like there is zero discussion about the Exodus, but in terms of what is the story of the Jewish people from degradation to praise, it's only Rav's opinion there. Okay? Okay. Time is short, so I want to move on to some other interesting stuff. Okay. Let's skip over 1 second to page 5. Why do we say our Haggadah and we don't say the Eretz Yisrael Haggadah? Why is that so important? You know, for all the Haggadahs that you find today, you're not going to find any of them that have Avadim Ayinu axed out and the much, much shorter version. Well, there's a very interesting fight that happens around when this Haggadah that was discovered in the Geniza met this Haggadah of the Babylonians. And we're going to take a look at it here on page 5. This is a responsum from Rav Natronai Gaon, who is one of the leaders of the Jewish community in Babylonia after the close of the Talmud. Okay, and Rav Natronai Gaon, who lives in the middle of the 9th century, he has the following to say about another Haggadah. Let's see if we can recognize it. Okay, here he says, Rabbi Natronai says, whoever says Kiddush on Pesach, Asher Kiddush at Yisrael, who has sanctified Israel, and when they finish Manishana, they don't say Avadim Hayinu Lefaro B'Mitzrayim, we were slaves to Pharaoh in Egypt, and doesn't say Mitchila Ovdei Avodah Zarah Hayu Avotenu, from the beginning our ancestors were idol worshippers. Rather, they just say Joshua spoke to the whole nation until, and Jacob and his sons went down to Egypt, and then they say Baruch Shomer until God go out and learn, say Ulamad, and they read my father was a wandering Aramean until the end of the section, with the Midrash verses as they are, and does not say any Midrash at all. We'll look at that in a second. And says Rabban Gamliel says, that's the Pesach Matzah and Maror, who has redeemed us in Hallel. There is a big surprise in this. He doesn't like this, okay? Now, we didn't do all these parts, but just the parts that we did. What's the Haggadah he's talking about? Sounds a lot like Eretz Yisrael. It's the Yushami Haggadah, right? He's saying, this is going to be a problem. Why? Let's read on. Whoever behaves in this way, it's not even necessary that he hasn't fulfilled his obligation, but also, whoever does this is a heretic, and of divided heart, and rejects the words of the sages, and scorns the words of the Mishnah and the Talmud. The communities must excommunicate this person and separate him from the congregation of Israel. Why is he so upset? What's the big deal? So this year I bought the new American Haggadah. Why are you yelling at me? Right? Okay? The Brahmin Haggadah. Okay? What's so problematic about it? Why go and put all of your gunfire against this? It's not that you didn't fulfill your obligation. For sure you didn't fulfill your obligation. But not only that, you're excommunicated. You're out of here. Right? What's the problem with this Haggadah? What's wrong with Rav's Haggadah? Well, let's read on. Okay? Didn't the Avadim Hayinu, the we were slaves that the sages said, come from the Torah? You should say to your child, we were slaves to Pharaoh, Avadim Hayinu LeFaroh B'Mitzrayim, right? Deuteronomy 6:21. And Joshua said to the whole people, that's Rav's part from the Yerushalmi, isn't this the same as in the beginning our ancestors were idol worshippers? That is to say, the Rav that we have in the Babylonian Talmud isn't quoting a verse. He's summarizing the verse. Isn't it the same thing? What's he concerned about? For we learn, begin with degradation and end in praise. And we said, what's degradation? Rav said from the beginning, and Shmuel said we were slaves. He's quoting the Babylonian Talmud. And unless they had ill will in their heart and didn't want to say words of Mishnah and Talmud, why would they care if they said Midchila? Why would they care if they said a paraphrase of the biblical verses as opposed to the biblical verses themselves? I'm giving you the answer now. Rather, they are heretics who mock and scorn the words of Chazal, the sages, and are students of Anan. His name be cursed. Uh-oh. Who's Anan? Karaites, right? Karaites are the guys who don't like the rabbinic tradition. They do like Torah verses. So if you have a Haggadah where all it says that you have to say is the Torah verses, you sound a lot like a Karaite. Now, whether or not these people were Karaites, actually, the Eretz Yisrael Haggadah, they were not Karaites. They were good from Palestinian Jews. Right? But the way in which Natronai Gaon is looking at it is to say, whether he's doing this because he doesn't know, he just heard of this Haggadah that doesn't have any summary of Scripture, but just has Scripture, or whether he's just trying to, you know, sort of a name call the Palestinian community, and and the worst name calling you could do is to call them Karaites, we don't know, right? Was he doing because he didn't know, or was he doing because it was like a good way to other them? But fundamentally, when you have a world in which you're quoting only Torah verses, you're suspicious of looking like a Karaite. And that is why you will not find in rabbinic descendants of Judaism the version of the Haggadah that only quotes what Rav says over here, that only has the Rav approach. And perhaps why we included Shmuel Rava's version as well. Okay, you with me so far? Should we do a quick summary? Our Gemara, our Haggadah says Rav and Shmuel Rava are both there. Avadim Hayinu is Shmuel Rava, and Michila from idolatry is Rav. That's all the one that we say. Much longer, wordier, etc. The Eretz Yisrael version is just the Rav version, which is all about idolatry, moving from idolatry to service. That's the only story that they're telling there. Or, potentially, not idolatry to service, but from wanderer to land. Okay, which makes sense for people who live in the land of Israel. Good. Any thoughts, questions, concerns as to where we are now? Please.
Why then, if we accepted both versions, why then is there so much material between the two versions? Why not actually, let us look at this,
why not just have them meet Tefillah first? Because that actually leads quite nicely to the Avodim HaYishuv. Why do you need to sandwich between that all this stuff about God and the Son?
Good. Okay, you're asking a great question, which is say, I get you. There was another Haggadah, it was a lot shorter, but that doesn't explain why my Haggadah has all these other elements and why they put them in the order that they did. Unfortunately, the answer is someone on test, I would say, we'll never really know because nobody explained it. There is a general idea that when you add things to liturgical documents, you're adding them in the beginning. Like if you think of the beginning of the Siddur, there is wide, wide variety in terms of what you say at the beginning of the Siddur, but the middle or the center is always going to be Shema and Amida. Right? But if you want to say Adon Olam in the morning, you want to say this blessing, that blessing, this Torah blessing, whatever, that's a wide variety. So it's possible that you were starting with a kernel in the beginning, in the middle, that became the middle. That was your kernel, and then you kind of keep adding. But to answer your question about why, what is there anything about these specific stories or sections that are related to our fundamental question, what is the story of the Jewish people? I want to look at two of them. Okay, because I think there is actually encoded in some of that addition stuff other versions of what the story of the Jewish people is. So to do that, let's just take a look at the very beginning of the Haggadah, which is on page 4. If you're like me, there's a lot of things in the Haggadah that just fly over you, and if you're not paying attention, you have to wait till next year or next night in Dulles. And this is one of them that sort of struck me this year. We start off in the Haggadah that we're familiar with in the Descendants of the Babylonian tradition, we start off with this is the bread of affliction, which again was missing in Eretz Yisrael, but is in fact in all of our Haggadahs, we love talking about it. All who are currently hungry, come and eat. It's a beautiful idea. Then we have these lines. Hashtahacha l'shana haba ba'aradi Yisrael. Right, hashtahacha. This year we are here. Next year we are in the land of Israel. Hashata avde l'shana haba b'nei chorin. This year we are slaves, next year we are free. What do we have here?
Wanderer dwelling.
Good, right? At least the first line is the move of wanderer to land, potentially Rav. Right? Potentially the idea of my father was a wandering Aramean and he took me out to this land. Right? And what about the second line? Hashata Avdel Hashana Abba B'nei Chorin. That's the slavery to freedom. Right? So already in Halach Ma'anya, at this point we're all excited. This is the beginning of the Seder. I can do it. Right? This is the beginning of Magi, and I'm paying attention still. What you have when you're paying attention in this moment is the fundamental summary of the debate. But it's not the debate we're familiar with. It's not the idolatry versus slavery debate. It's the land versus slavery debate. Right? It's the wanderer versus the slavery debate. Okay? And that's the one in which we start off. I got it. Yeah, Tila.
That's an interesting move because it's not just the story. It becomes the wish. Right, that's the way in which we can put into the Haggadah the story of like being wandering and then going to the land of Israel. Because if we're not in the land of Israel, the only way we can incorporate that into the Haggadah is to say, oh, we want to be there.
Uh-huh.
Like it moves from an actual story that happened into say the reality is one thing and we
want to
be in a different.
Good. All of a sudden, the story that we're telling here from degradation to praise, we actually haven't hit the praise yet. Right? We're on the way. Next year we'll get there. Right? That's not the same as I'm telling a story that has ultimately a happy ending. And in fact, if you were going to look at the context of the verses of what Rav suggests you say, how do I say the words moving from idolatry or from land to the praise of the corresponding one? It's this story at the end of Joshua. And what Joshua does, we stop after the Jews make it out of Egypt, right? But in fact, that story in Joshua goes through all of Jewish history up until the point where Joshua is standing there today. Right, and it ends with, did you read the story in the Styles section this week from Bruce Feiler about what healthy families tell stories about themselves? And the stories are one, the best story that you can tell about yourself is not a linear story, but it's one with ups and downs. That's the Joshua story. The Joshua story, this was the point made about monotheism, right? The idea was that, you know, well, we took you out of Egypt, but then things went sour, and then things were better, and then things went sour again, right? It's the full family story. That's the story of Rav that is, if you're going to read on the full context in the end of Joshua, that's what happens. And it ends with, the ending of that story is, Joshua saying, I don't know about you guys, but I'm going to be a monotheist. I'm going to, you know, I'm going to serve God. And then, and the people say, yes, we will also serve God. He's like, no, you're not going to serve God. I know what's going to happen. It's not going to end well for you. And they say, no, 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 we are going to do it. And then Joshua says, okay, this is a covenant, right? You have again committed yourself to being faithful to God. Because it's a new generation that's come out, and it's a sort of reenactment of Sinai. But what's, I think, important is that it's a story that has a lot more ups and downs than just the simple plot line of slavery to freedom. Yeah.
Something that's been bothering me all along has been, why are shame and praise mutually exclusive here? Mm. Like looking at Psalms in particular, there are a lot of times when the praise for God is happening right in the midst of everything else. And what I just realized is that the idolatry one is the only one that actually takes care of that issue, because only in idolatry are you actually precluded from praising God. But while you're a slave, you can praise God. And while you're wandering, you can praise God. But when you're an idolater, you're not.
Okay, great. Good, good, good. So what Molly's raising is a question which I would frame as, what is the nature of the praise? If the nature of the praise is praising God, so then you can't do that when you're an idolater. But in any other way, you sort of could go back and forth. I want to look at another version of the story in which praise comes out, but it's not necessarily related to God. Because again, the Mishnah says from degradation to praise. But what is the praise that we're talking about? We assume that the praise is talking something praiseworthy towards God. But let's just take a look at one other aspect of the Haggadah. On the same page, page 4. This is the full section of Shmuel's, Rava's, debate with Rav. We started in slavery and we ended coming out of Egypt. So let's just look at it. Number 11 on page 4. We were slaves to Pharaoh in Egypt, but Hashem our God took us out of there with a mighty hand and an outstretched arm. And if the Holy One, blessed be He, had not taken our ancestors out of Egypt, then we, our children and our grandchildren, would still be enslaved to Pharaoh and Mitzrayim. And even if we were all wise, we were all perceptive, we were all elders, we were all learned in Torah, it would still be our duty to tell about the Exodus from Egypt. And the more one talks about the Exodus from Egypt, behold, this is praiseworthy. Harezeh Meshubach. Right? Now, I'm arguing, we have another story from degradation to praise. This could have ended very easily by saying, slaves, we were slaves to Paro, and then we went out of there. Vayotzienu Misham. Okay, and in fact, if you look at the way in which Rava says things in that section of Gemara, Rava says two things, not Shmuel now. Rava says, you have to say, we were slaves, and Rava says, Amar Rava Tzarich Yomar V'otanu Hotzi Misham. Rava says, you have to talk about leaving, and Rava says, you have to talk about being slaves, and you have to talk about leaving. That's what Rava bounds you as, Gnut and Sheva, of degradation and praise. But here, we actually move in a different arc. We were slaves, and then we were free. And now, what's the praiseworthy thing? Not that we are free, but that we are telling the story. Right? The praiseworthy aspect of the Haggadah is the telling. Right? As I mentioned before, it's the only night when the commandment is to tell. Not to remember, but to tell. This is the praiseworthy activity. So I think in sort of in contrast to what Tila noted is, if Halach Ma'anya is, I am in the middle of the story goes from way back when, and I haven't gotten to next year, right? This year I am either wandering or I am enslaved, and next year, which I haven't gotten to, I'm praiseworthy. Now, where's the praiseworthy event happening? It's not in the past, which was when I decided to be serving God or coming out of Egypt. It's not in the future, which is when I really will be sort of ultimately redeemed. It's in the present, right? It's in the present moment right now in the act of telling the story of the going out of, or whatever, whichever story we pick. The point is that whoever talks about going out of Egypt more, you know, increases in that, that is the praiseworthy thing. So we've moved from a model of past stories, future stories, and now present story. Yeah, Tori.
I learned recently from the podcast, I think, that
that basically these lists of going from like disgrace to praise and all the other ones, it's like you have to think of them as opposites of the same essence. So no matter where you're plugging into, like whichever narrative is speaking to you or whichever one you're interpreting, the way you have to understand it is that the narrative of the story is like the central piece. And going from disgrace to praise, like with having that same essence in mind.
Uh huh. Great.
It's less about like, you know, where it's coming from, you know, from another end, but more personally, like the spectrum that you're working on.
Great. Okay. So you could ultimately, you know, focus on what's sort of the kernel. That's an issue that actually unites all of these stories, and then they're all versions of the same idea. Yes, please.
Some sort of a historical question. In any of this debate, Rob versus Shmuel, was there some concern about the underlying political situation with the Romans, whether the primary concern was we Jews are becoming slaves to the Romans, or we Jews are becoming assimilated and therefore becoming idolaters like the Romans?
Right, well, by the time of Rav and Rava, or Rav and Shmuel, the Romans are out of the picture, but fundamentally, you know, the question about whether or not they were reacting to an outside, an outside influence is one that's taken up in scholarship. Actually, there's one scholar at Hebrew University, Israel Yuval, who has made an entire career basically out of pointing out that every liturgical innovation or decision by the rabbis was a direct response to Christian expounding. Because what's missing here? Well, if I stop a Jew, this is great. The Bronfman family just put out a new Haggadah. And what they said was, it turns out that in Haggadah, if you look carefully, the story of the Exodus isn't there. Now it is there, but it's just very, very short. Right? But what we would have expected is, you know, let's start reading the book of Exodus from the time when they went out that night and all the great stuff that, you know, says there. And there's like hints of it, you know, the four sons, but fundamentally it's not there. So Yisrael Yuval says, well, the reason it isn't there is because there were many Christian, how do you say, exegetes, who were taking the chapter 12 of Exodus and drawing very strong Christian typologies from it, right? And so they say, well, we're not going to talk about Exodus 12. That actually hasn't been accepted ultimately in wider scholarship, but it is an interesting guessing game about how much of this is a reaction to the ruling party, as it were. So we leave that in the sort of unanswered column. Okay, yeah, please.
I was thinking about the paragraph of Abba Din Hayinu is actually both the story from wandering to the land and from slavery to coming out of slavery, but by actually telling that story, you're actually expanding on monotheism.
The act of telling includes good. That's nice. Okay. I know you all have to go home and start cleaning soon. So I just want to end with one last approach to the story here. The last approach to the story I want to look at is on page 6. And this gets to your question about what was all that other stuff that they threw in there in the Babylonian Talmud. So hopefully we've dealt a little bit more with what was Halach Ma'anya, also has a story of from degradation to praise. And what was the full version of Shmuel, also has the praise element of telling the story, bringing it into the now. And what I want to end with is that whole thing about the debate between Ben Zoma and the sages about when am I supposed to tell the story of Yitziat Mitzrayim. Okay, so I'm on the bottom of page 6. This shows up to a point in our Haggadah, but the continuation is the important part that's not in our Haggadah, but tells us one last example of what it means to tell the story of the Jewish people. Okay, so I'm in number 14 on page 6. We mention, Mazkirin, we mention the Exodus from Egypt at night. Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah said, here I am 70 years old and I have not yet merited to hear the Exodus from Egypt spoken at night until Ben Zoma derived from this verse, as it says, so that you remember, Laman Tizkor, the day that you left from the land of Egypt all the days of your life, on page 7. Why does the verse say all the days of your life? Had the verse been written the days of your life, it would just mean the days. Okay, so what's the exegetical problem they're dealing with? Kol Yemei Chayecha. This is in Nagara. Kol Yemei Chayecha. All the days of your life you have to tell the story. Remember the story. All the days of your life. What's the all? Could have just said the days of your life. I get it. All the days. It's the same as the day. So what's the kol? What's the all? Here's the debate. Right? Had the verse been written the days of your life, it would mean just the days. Since the verse is written all the days, this includes the nights. Okay, Ben Zoma says what All the days would have been just the day. The days would have been just the daytime. All the days means day and night. But it's in a debate. The rabbis say the days of your life means the days, that is say day and night. All the days of your life comes to include the days of the Messiah. Okay? Now this is in the Haggadah, and the Haggadah moves on, right? What is, first of all, it's important to recognize this is a debate. The Haggadah is preserving a debate, and the debate is, when am I supposed to tell this story? Is it all the days meaning day and night, that's why the Seder is at night? Or is it all the days meaning, of course day and night is included in the days, but the real, all the days is the future time. So it's a debate. What it means is that the majority opinion thinks that in the future, you will tell the story of the Exodus. Right? In the redeemed world, the Exodus story is part of the world. That's the narrative that you're saying in the redeemed world. Ben Zoma says no. Right? Ben Zoma says, and he's going to argue it right here. Let's take a look at it. Ben Zoma said to them, must we mention the Exodus from Egypt during the days of the Messiah? But doesn't it already say in Jeremiah, therefore behold, the days come, says God, that it shall be no more said, as God lives, that brought up the children of Israel out of the land of Egypt, but as God lives, that brought up the children of Israel from the land of the north. Right? In other words, he's got a pretty good proof text. He quotes a proof text from Jeremiah that says, in the future, they're not going to describe God as the God who took the children of Israel out of Egypt, but in fact who redeemed, you know, the kingdom, right? The northern, you know, the northern kingdom. Brought them up from the land of the north. Right? That is to say, the story of redemption from Egypt is something that is only good in this time. In ultimate future time, it's out. Ben Zoma, that's his opinion. But the majority opinion fights back, and they said to him, that is not to say that the Exodus from Egypt would be excised from its place, but that the Exodus from Egypt will be added to the oppression of the foreign kingdoms. The kingdoms will be central, and the Exodus from Egypt will be peripheral. What Chachamim are saying is, the story of the Exodus doesn't disappear. The story of the Exodus becomes more peripheral, but it's always something that is deeply encoded in the Jewish people's DNA. Right? And getting to Elisheva's question, what is the essence of the Jewish people? The essence of the Jewish people, this is the debate that they're having here as well. What is the story of the Jewish people and when does it end? Does the story of the Jewish people, which is so clearly wrapped up with the Exodus, does that end when we've reached a redeemed world? Or in fact, does that story remain with us even when we're redeemed? Right? Ultimately, in the future perfect time, this story stays with us. And that's essentially what the rabbis are saying. Ben Zoma says, this is a story that works in the here and now, but it's not an ultimate story. And the majority opinion says, no, it is an ultimate story. The story of the Exodus is something that will last forever. It moves in relationships, right? It's not the ultimate central story, but it's something that never goes away. And I think this is something that we can take home, hopefully, to our seders and to our understanding of what the Jewish people is, which is to say, first of all, the story of the Jewish people is fundamentally in debate. Okay? Fundamentally, we do not have one clear approach about telling us what the arc of the story of the Jewish people is. And not only is it in debate, but its force is in debate as well. That is to say, even if we were to settle upon choosing one of these streams, we ultimately also in the Haggadah have a debate about how long this story goes on. Will I, in the redeemed world, be sitting at a Seder? Or will I not? Will I remember this story as part of me forever? Or will I not? And I think that's the fundamental debate that's going on between the sages and Ben Zoma that's right there in the middle of the Haggadah, which is to say, is this story something that is so significant that you could never let go of it? Is the story of the journey something that stays with you forever? Or is it something that gets you to another place, and once you've gotten to that place, you let it go? The majority opinion says, it's with you forever. It may move in its ups and downs in terms of its centrality to your own expression, but it never goes away. The minority opinion says it does go away. So I leave it for you to figure out, and may we all reach a redeemed world when we find out that answer. Thank you.